tell me about how you got your start with your career in the markets.
Well, that's a loaded question. I was actually in real estate as in my early 20s. And one of the gaps that developers have, certainly over here, typically is that they are short on finance knowledge. And so I was determined to do that. So I started taking what you would call Wall Street exams, tests. And then I got struck by a very unpleasant illness in, again, my early 20s. So I was doing my real estate exams and I was doing my financial exams all at the same time. And then I got hit by this horrible illness, an intestinal thing. And long story short, by the time I got better from that, I enrolled on a finance MBA at what was then City University Business School. It was very finance orientated, right in the heart of the financial district. Now it's gone through two name changes. Now it's known as Bayes Business School, but that was it. And having just overcome a rather unpleasant illness, we had the choice of electives. And of course, I was feeling top of the world and very brave. So I went for the most difficult electives, like options and futures, which were the ones that everyone was very frightened of. And at the time, I was not going to be frightened by anything. And that's how I got into it. And then what happened is that I didn't really care for the software that was available to help options traders at the time. We're talking about the mid to late 1990s. And so I started building my own. I started building a spreadsheet, and that just morphed and morphed and morphed. And eventually, an author from the Financial Times, who'd been a prolific author at the Financial Times, saw what I'd done. And he goes, "I think you've got a book here. Why don't you speak to my friends at FT Pearson?" And I did, and they, long story short again, they said, "Oh, I think there's a book here. Do you want to write a book?" And I said, "Okay." Wrote a book, but it became a bestseller. And then they said, "Do you want to write another one?" I go, "Okay." And that became a bestseller as well. And by that point, I was already building the software out of the spreadsheet into a web application. And that was really the whole birth of the whole thing.
So what were the names of the books, and what were they about?
So the book number one was Options Made Easy. That's still a seller out there. It's in its third edition, multiple languages, etc. And the second book was called The Bible of Options Strategies. And that book is on an awful lot of Wall Street desks. And there's pretty much every trader I see, they go, "Oh, I got your book on my desk," because they use it as a reference guide to learn about a lot of different strategies. And that's, you know, also a multi-edition book in multiple languages too. And that's also, you know, we have that as a dynamic website too. So it's a reference guide. And of course, you know, John, your own trading understanding and knowledge, particularly if you do quanti stuff and academic stuff and, you know, stuff that we do, it evolves over time as more information becomes available. And that's what's happened. And so, you know, we approach the markets in a very much supply and demand kind of spirit. And so everything that we do has to be interpreted in that way. Otherwise, we won't use it.
So you wrote a couple more books as well, it looks like.
I did indeed. They weren't bestsellers, so let's not talk about them. Well, and what was funny, actually, interesting enough, Volatile Markets Made Easy was one that I wrote in 2008-09, you know, obviously in line with what was going on then. And that was a cracking book. And actually, The Insider Edge, which was published by Wiley, the other three were by F.T. Pearson, F.T. Prentice Hall, just didn't get never got any exposure. The publishers said to me, "Oh, you've got to market it." I go, "Well, why would I get it published then?" So I think what happened in the publishing world, that the marketing approach changed. So it's a shame they didn't quite get the exposure that they could have got. But in the new editions of Options Made Easy and The Bible, I kind of weaved all that new stuff in anyway. So it's all fine.
So you've written these books and you've become a best-selling author. What was next?
Well, at the same time of doing that, I was obviously building my own software platform. And there was a tender for Euronext, the big exchange that had just taken over the Life Exchange in London, in Europe, where they were wanting a retail-based options education and application program. And again, long story short, I won the tender. So we did a white label of my options platform for Euronext Life. Now, happily for me, And this is just one of those nice little coincidences that you might get on in your life once or twice. Shortly after all that, NYSE bought out Euronext. So now my client was NYSE, which is a much better known client than Euronext. So that obviously, you know, at that point, you're starting to build a reputation, you know, with some nice blue chip clients.
At what point did you start to work with NASDAQ and ISE?
Yeah, so ISE was pre-NASDAQ, and this is now in 2011. They had a product which was based on opening buying volumes, and they wanted to test it. They didn't have the mechanisms to test how effective it was. And so we did, and we do, and so we did some number crunching for them on that basis. And the upshot of that all was that it's a lot easier to make predictive analysis from the bullish side than it is from the bearish side when it comes to options data. And we could go into that if you want, or we can pause there.
Well, let's talk about that for just a second. So what is it about options data that makes it easier to figure out bullish information?
Well, I think that the motivation on calls is probably a little easier to understand than puts. I mean, say for example, and I'm you can only surmise this with options transaction data. Now, we've been doing this for over 20 years, so we were pioneers in this. You're always dealing in possibilities, not absolutes. But if you think about some logic, there's an awful lot of put activity on the short side out of the money in order for people to acquire stocks at cheaper rates. It's a common Warren Buffett strategy. So you never quite know what's the buying, what's the selling volume, and what the motivations are. This is one of the big issues with options data, particularly, you know, the new fad of unusual options data or unusual options activity. It really isn't going to be as straightforward as that, and there's no numbers that bear that out. But the motivations behind call activity appear to be relatively easier to interpret than other put activity. And I can only surmise it's due to the motivations of the short side rather than the long side. And I suspect that there are many more complicated call strategies, you know, employing call legs, than there are put strategies. And that's my, you know, that's my theory over 20 years of looking at this stuff and trying to understand why. And we're talking about a balance of probabilities here as well. We're not saying that it's, you know, put activity is useless. It's not. But it's just not as, you know, statistically, you are going to have better odds quantitatively on the long side than the short side.
You built this web tool. Who were the clients for it besides NYSE, Euronext, and ISE and all?
Well, so ISE just took the analysis, Euronext took the platform, and then from all that, then we started to cater a little bit to retail customers and retail publications. So, you know, there were some experienced stock pickers, you and I know one or two of those guys mutually, and they started to rely on the kind of output that we had and still do. So, you know, there's an awful lot of newsletters out there that we're kind of behind the scenes and no one knows we are because we don't need to be known for it. But we're behind quite a lot of, you know, stock picking services while not being, you know, the front face of it, but our technology is behind it.
So you have developed the OVI, the Options Volatility Indicator. How did you develop this and what does it do?
Well, now we go back. If you go back to the genesis of this, go back to my finance MBA, 1996, 1997, there were two professors that I had for options. One was called Gordon Gemmell, a very academic professor type fellow and who didn't trade. And then there was another one called Dr. Kevin Connolly, who was a very experienced trader, had been, you know, worked with many of the big blue chip banks and et cetera, and he was a visiting professor. But in separate lectures, they were talking about, well, and this is the words they said, is look, if you want to beat the stock market, figure out what the options traders are doing. And what they were saying was kind of tongue in cheek, but it resonated with me. And obviously, as I started my journey at that point and I started collecting options data, I was, you know, my 20s at the time, I had a lot of energy into my 30s as well. And I would just watch this stuff. I'd look at option chains, you know, night after night. And you begin to pick up a qualitative feel for things. And obviously, I was experimenting, trading, building my platform. And that was the genesis of it. Now, by around 2008, that had all morphed into this concept of, let's look at this data, but let's find a way of automating it. Let's find a way of expressing it in a way that's easy to understand. And then if it is, then we can do studies on it as well. And that's how the OVI was born. It was obviously a long process. I didn't sort of wake up one day thinking I'm going to do this. It was just that real gradual process. And then the next step was then to have quantitative analysis pour over it to see, well, is it as good as what we think it is?
So what does it do?
Well, it's quite good to explain it in terms of what it doesn't do, because the whole rage right now is this unusual options activity. That's not what we do. And there's many reasons why unusual options activity is very fashionable, but it's very flawed and it ultimately won't work. But what we're looking to do is pinpoint what could be. And again, I said earlier, we're not dealing in absolutes, we're dealing in possibilities and logic. What could be position building activity? And there are reasons for that too. Now, if you can identify what might be position building activity, which then has a knock-on effect in the actual underlying stock prices and stock activity, then you might have something very interesting from a logic perspective. And then, of course, you've got to see whether it bears out in the quantitative world as well. So you never quite know, but we're using all aspects of options pricing and liquidity. Whereas unusual options activity is just looking at kind of volume spikes or open interest spikes. And that's just not enough. So there's a lot more that goes into it. We use an awful lot more data to create the indicator. And we are looking for very specific kinds of activity that could lend themselves to position building on the long side, on the bullish side and the bearish side.
And then what can you do with that?
Well, once you've created what we've created, then you can study it. You can test it. You can do things quantitatively with it. Now, as a visual representation, it helps if it's easy to understand and easy to deploy, which it is. So we have a line that's normalized from -1 to +1. When it's in negative territory, we might associate it with bearish activity or bearish outlook. And when it's in bullish territory, we would associate that with, sorry, when it's in positive territory, we would associate that with bullish activity potentially. But of course, different stocks at different times have different correlations to this indicator that we do for each one of them. And so one has to be cognizant of that. Sometimes what you see in the options world is very difficult to interpret and might just be noise. So we're looking for specific kind of behaviors at specific kind of times, which might well give us an edge. And then obviously the quant studies will tell you if it does give you an edge. Luckily for us, it does. So it's not, we're not looking at unusual options activity like has become so fashionable. We're looking at something quite different. And then what you can do with it, John, of course, is a lot. You can create retail discretionary strategies on it, long, short, and different option strategies based on the underlying, or so you can create strategies based on the underlying, or you can create option strategies on it. Plus, you can create quant strategies based on portfolios. Our universe is S&P 500. So we can create strategies based on that, long only, long flat, long short, market neutral, etc.
Who is using the OVI now?
So at this moment in time, we have professional users using it in various ways. We have retail users using it in more discretionary trading ways, and ourselves, of course. And the next step is to then push this into the hedge fund territory. So we're quite far down the line of going down for our own launch of a market neutral S&P 500 strategy.
So where does the OVI fit in all of that?
Well, it's really all down to the quant study. So we have a a philosophy, if you like, a hypothesis that we're trying to identify position building activity. How does that then impact stock trading strategies on the long side, on the short side, and then on the long short situation? And when you're measuring performance, obviously you're looking at absolute returns, you're looking at risk-adjusted returns, you're looking at obviously volatility, and you're looking at correlations to benchmarks and what they call factor analysis. So without getting too technical, factor analysis is how your strategy compares and correlates to the five main factors, for which there are very significant ETFs that you can just lean into those. So those factors are momentum, size, quality, volatility, and value stocks. And if your strategy correlates with those, then okay, you might have a good strategy, but yeah, we could just use the ETF. We could just mimic it. Now, if your strategy doesn't correlate with that and you have an edge over your benchmarks, then you might have something quite valuable. That's the aim. That's what you want. And there's this concept called idiosyncratic returns. And idiosyncratic returns is how much of your performance is due to those five factors, combined or isolated. And if you have a high idiosyncratic proportion of returns, then that's a good thing because it means that your strategy is unlikely to be mimicked and it's more likely to last. And so that's what one is always going to hope for. And that's what will make it more sellable into the institutions ultimately too. Now there's an important piece to that, which I omitted. In our strategy, all of that comes down to this options volatility indicator. You can literally chart it. When you can turn it on, turn it off, and you'll see that idiosyncratic proportion dives down when we don't have OVI in there and pumps up when it does. So we have that mathematical trail.
So walk me through a trade how OVI would be used.
So I think that in that case, we would look at a retail discretionary kind of trade, in which case other factors are coming into or other, you know, characteristics are looking into, we're looking into those. So for example, we don't just look in the options data alone and ignore everything else that's going on. What we want to see is some kind of consensus that, say, buyers are in control of the situation or sellers are losing control of the situation. So an interesting example recently, there's actually many. There was a bit of news out on the June the 3rd saying that the day before, June the 2nd, there was an unusual bit of options activity, a big spike. And obviously, people were going to jump onto that. Now, interestingly enough, the stock price from that date has gone sideways. But what we were looking at, and again, we talked about this. We don't want to highlight, you know, cherry-picked situations. But this was quite an interesting one because it hit the news. But what we could see, the way that we look at things, was that activity, whatever that would be, but the way that we look at it, was happening a couple of weeks before that. So whatever happened on June the 2nd was actually too late, or at least later than what we were seeing. Might not end up being too late, but certainly later than what we were seeing. So if we would look at a chart and look at the indicator, we were seeing things in middle of May, and that's what unusual option activity was not picking up. That's one. Now, what we would do is we would use that information and say, well, what else is going on with the stocks? So there are a couple of other parameters based on the underlying that we will look at, which would hint towards a supply-demand imbalance and a safe place to trade. So, you know, you'll know from hundreds of interviews you've done and your trading knowledge that, you know, people like consolidations. Well, statistically, flags and consolidations have no particular quantitative merit, but they're really good for defining your risk, your entry and your exit points. And so we would use that kind of thing more for that kind of trading, you know, use for risk control rather than, oh, it's a flag, isn't it amazing? I mean, 2/3 of flags don't even break out, so, or 70%. So you trade all the flags, you're already going to lose 70%, let alone the ones that do false breakouts afterwards. So we use technical analysis very sparingly in a very different way to what other people might do. We look to a chart not for lines and averages and other things. We look to anthropomorphize the chart to say, who's winning here? Buyers or sellers? Who's taking control? And that's what we, you know, hope to train people to look at a chart, not the way everyone else is. And when you can see that clearly, then you have opportunities.
Now, are you using the S&P 500 itself to trade this, or are you using the underlying stocks, or how are you trading it?
Typically underlying stocks, because what we're also looking at is an information edge. So a lot of, you know, options activity that we're looking at will happen before earnings, will also happen after earnings. But there appears to be an information situation that's there. Now, we don't need to go into, you know, whether it's dodgy or whether it's just good information and good analysis. It doesn't matter to us. But there, we're looking to see, is there likely information that is going to help propel this stock in the direction which we think it's going to go? And so, yes, we're looking at the underlying stocks, but it's also got some use for the main indices, the really liquid ones, the SPY, not so much DIA, but Qs and IWM are also very good for this.
With the hedge fund that you're looking to build, how scalable is that relative to the use of this tool?
More. So we only deal long and short S&P 500 stocks. In fact, short, we only do S&P 250s, the top 250. So it's very liquid. We rebalance only once a week, and the portfolio turnover is not that much. So it's very scalable. I mean, even without, we would go 2x leverage on it, but even with 1x, we can go to 5 billion and not have a problem, because it's just that liquid, and it's just that scalable, that it has enormous capacity. So again, it's very attractive from the point of view of targeting institutions. But as you and I have spoken about before, you need to get to a certain threshold to get their attention. So that's what we have to do.
So you decided to patent this. Why'd you decide to patent this? And was there anything else that was similar to this that you were concerned about?
Well, it was actually one of my banking friend advisors. He said, you ought to try and patent this, quite a long time ago. And I thought, that's a good idea. Obviously, I had no idea what that would entail. But what was decided was, well, I don't want to give away a complex algorithm that could be tremendously valuable. So what we decided to do was patent the display of it, because the display of it is very, very simple. And it condenses, if I would put it in layman's terms, it condenses options volume, open interest, and implied volatility all into one indicator. And that's not been done any time before. And we stick it underneath the stock chart. And if someone else wants to try and do that, they can't. Now, they can stick implied vol below a chart, that's okay, or volume, or open interest, but not the merging of any two or any three of them. And that's what we patented, which of course has a big value in the retail space, because no one else can do it from a legal perspective. So that's what we did, and that was what was patented. And it wasn't an easy journey. There was rejected and appealed several times.
So the indicator is patented. Have you had anybody that has wanted to license the patent, or what are you doing with it?
Yes, there is a lot of that going on. So we are, doing white labels, co-brands. So, because, we're talking about such vast liquidity. We're not going to, when our universe is so large and so liquid that by having other people use it, and they're probably stronger marketers than us, especially as we go into the hedge fund world, we can't do that much marketing anyway, then they can leverage it and get it shown to an awful lot more people who can benefit from it. And on that point, quite an interesting one too, is that the way that it's used in the quant world, on the fund world, and the way it's used in the visual discretionary retail world is quite different. And so they use the same common ancestor, but the mutations are significant from the visual display to then the quantitative approach, so that both can live side by side and they're not mutually exclusive and they don't correlate with each other. So what people do in retail really bears nothing to do with what we're doing in the quant world.